Entrepreneurial Leadership at the University of Illinois, a resource for UIUC faculty and students with entrepreneurial ideas and aspirations. More information on the Academy can be found at www.ael.uiuc.edu. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Pages for All Ages, Books, Music, Cafe, and DVDs, located at the corner of Route 45 South and Curtis Road in Savoy. Pages for All Ages offers a wide selection of books, compact discs, stationery, magazines, DVDs, children's books, and gift ideas, and features a full line of coffee, drinks, and teas at Pages Cafe. On the web at www.pagesforallages.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Reporter and editor Jed Horn calls Hurricane Katrina an unnatural disaster. He says the storm, which struck New Orleans late in August of 2005, was, quoting here, unnatural in its scale and destructiveness, but also unnatural in the sense that it was not limited causally to the forces of nature, to weather and geography and tides. Katrina, says Horn, has been essentially a man-made disaster. Jed Horn is Metro editor for the Times-Picayune of New Orleans. He is also the author of Breach of Faith, Hurricane Katrina, and the Near Death of a Great American City. The book offers us a look at a huge story. Horn says while Katrina taught the people of New Orleans much about themselves and their city, it is also a lesson for America about itself. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Jed Horn. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else you can call toll-free. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Jed Horn was awarded a Pulitzer Prize for his part in the paper's coverage of Katrina. His book, Desire Street, A True Story of Death and Deliverance in New Orleans, was nominated for the 2006 Edgar Award for Nonfiction Crime Writing. He's a native of Massachusetts. Except for a posting in Latin America early in the 1990s, he has made his home in New Orleans with his wife and their children since the late 1980s. Horn's book, Breach of Faith, Hurricane Katrina, and the Near Death of a Great American City, is published by Random House. And again, the phone numbers 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Jed Horn, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, Celeste, it's my pleasure.
A lesson for America about itself. What lesson or lessons about ourselves should we take from Katrina?
Katrina was the first real test of what will remain, in addition to the Iraq War, the major achievement of the Bush administration, which is to say the Homeland Security bureaucracy. It was not a promising debut. I think many of us are aware of just how completely flawed that response turned out to be. Many, many deaths, more than were initially going to have to be recorded, were the result of delays, confusion, chaos, partisan politics, if you will. And, you know, in that way, it was, I think, deeply disturbing. A hurricane is an easy thing to anticipate, if not to defend against. They come slowly across the Gulf. We've had them countless times. How much worse if it's the dirty bomb in the Chicago subway system or in New York or something insinuated under the legs of the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco? There, the response has to be, you know, instantaneous and exceedingly accurate, and we do not have evidence, certainly Katrina did not provide evidence, that this enormous bureaucracy, this commitment to defend us against terrorism, is anywhere close to ready for prime time.
On the one hand, we have this huge bureaucracy, Homeland Security, and we also have resources for other agencies, such as FEMA and the Army Corps of Engineers, being reduced.
Well, and that's all part of the same game, because FEMA has been incorporated into Homeland Security, and that turned out to be one of the sources of great confusion. And it has been beggared because Mike Chertoff, in his wisdom, felt that terrorism was the flavor of the day, and that we should devote far more towards terrorism and deplete the available responses to the so-called natural disasters like hurricanes and earthquakes. And it turns out that Katrina was at least as vicious as Osama bin Laden ever might have been. The Army Corps is another institution that should throw terror into the hearts of many Americans far from Louisiana, because it, of course, is responsible for dams and bulwarks and bridges and important parts of the infrastructure all over the country. Our discovery here has been that, and the Army Corps has acknowledged it, terrible design flaws, processes of administration and contracting that clearly contributed to this, as you put it, and as I heartily concur, unnatural disaster.
Hmm. Another lesson you suggest for the administration is that it has been too rigid and top-down.
Yeah, I think there was evidence, clear evidence of that, particularly in the first week, and it was revealed in the startling aloofness of the president. I understand the flow chart. I understand the logic of it. You spare the president the nitty gritty and the details and the distractions of micromanagement, and no president should be a micromanager. But the upshot, as was revealed in Katrina's first week, was a president completely out of touch and unaware of what was going on. The contrast that many people here are mindful of is the contrast with Lyndon Johnson back in 65, when Hurricane Betsy packed a wallop and flooded much of New Orleans. The very next day, Johnson, in a memorable vignette, got himself into some shelter, some gymnasium, electricity-less, unair-conditioned like the worst of the Superdome at its nadir. Johnson turned a flashlight on his face, stood up in all of his 6-foot-4 glory, and began speaking to the people and telling them he was there and telling them he was responding. And indeed, the federal establishment did respond. It was not as severe a catastrophe as Katrina. Bush, by contrast, flew over the city a few days later in that very strange moment when his handlers let a picture be taken of him sort of peeking out the window at, 30,000 feet, and then came back finally 5 days after the hurricane to meet with public officials on the tarmac. That was emblematic. Clearly, he was, by then very much aware and involved in the decision-making, but it had an emblematic response here. It was a symptom of how far out of the loop he had gotten.
Hmm. Now, so many months later, what do you think of where we are today in terms of the federal response, in terms of what's going on today?
Well, I think we have actually found an ally in Don Powell, the liaison to the entire Katrina disaster zone, and that includes, of course, parts of Alabama and the coastal Mississippi area and virtually all of Louisiana's southern reaches. Powell, after what I think was an uncertain start, has, I think, been convinced. He's been infected with the sense we people have down here of just how urgent the situation is. And to his credit, he has learned, he has listened, and he has carried the message, carried the water to the White House, and has found at least some support there. And it has taken the form of the billions in CDBG block grants that are so important now as we attempt to rebuild our housing. The 11 months that have elapsed is a disappointment. These are decisions that could and should have been made from the get-go. But at long last, and blessings upon Don Powell, we're beginning to see some of that. He also understood the politics down here, helped force the local legislature into some necessary reforms of the way the levy boards are structured. That may sound like a highly technical and irrelevant issue, but in truth, the fractured, balkanized levee boards rife with patronage and corruption for which Louisiana is duly famous needed to be consolidated, needed to be professionalized, and he came down here and glowered at the legislature and made sure that that was going to happen, and for this we can only commend him. He's worked very, very well with the state-level people and they with him.
What about regional planning? What were the relationships like between the key political players, governors and mayors in the Gulf Coast states, and what's the situation today?
I think Katrina is potentially a shot in the arm for regional planning and coordination, certainly of emergency response. And the Contraflow plan, which is where all the interstates are turned in one direction away from the city, worked for the first time very, very well. The pre-Katrina evacuation of 1.5 million people from southeast Louisiana was the largest, and I think by any account, the most successful evacuation in history. And for that, again, the state people deserve some credit. There were huge lapses, the failure to use the city buses, the city school buses, until they had flooded and were no longer usable was, of course, a mistake, and that's been recognized, and they are now part of a flood response or a hurricane response plan that would have them removed from the city and then brought back in quickly so nobody has to wait a week sitting in squalor and backed up sewage to be hauled out of the city. But one of the problems, and this is a serious one, and it's not necessarily remedied, is that the entire communications infrastructure failed down here. As completely as the levees failed, so too did the cell towers and the interoperable communication networks that are meant to link police and fire and all of the rest of that. The governor could not seem to rouse Ray Nagin from the hotel where he had taken refuge. She flew down here a couple of different times the day after the storm and was really very active in trying to draw attention to the problems. But, you know, in that vacuum that was created, these terrible myths and stereotyping and, all manner of fear and paranoid kinds of imagery cropped up and only worsened the situation. At one point, based on some of these rumors, which turned out not to be true, FEMA had pulled its people back for 6 to 8 hours. People die during those 6 and 8 hour intervals. People who came down here to help with boats, bringing their own boats in, an old and hallowed local tradition in a very water-wise part of the state, were turned back by FEMA, forbidden to go out onto the waters of the flooded city and rescue people from the rooftops, and FEMA's explanation was that the city was unsafe. Well, let's think about that statement in its profound and utter absurdity. Of course the city was unsafe. That's why hundreds and hundreds of people came in boats to try to save people who were surely going to die and did die as a result of that lapse of judgment by FEMA.
Mm. How do you think the mayor did? How do you think the governor did overall in their performances?
It's been interesting to watch the two of them and the evolution in public attitudes toward them. And I'm not sure that the final analysis can be made. Nagin has been attacked pretty savagely by some of the instant historians of this event. I certainly find occasion to criticize some of what he did. It should be remembered that Nagin, whatever his performance during Katrina, has actually been a very effective mayor prior to, a reform mayor in a city and in a political culture that is not at all amenable to reform. But he stepped aside and let the feds in, and some rather hideous patterns of corruption were being rooted out before the storm. In its immediate aftermath, I think he was no Rudy Giuliani, and he hates that comparison. He's quick to point out that Giuliani was able to taxi home from. Giuliani was the mayor of New York. For members of your audience who are unfamiliar with that story, but he, Giuliani could go back up to Gracie Mansion in a cab. Nagin was, unable to bathe or shower or communicate and was sleeping on the floor in a hotel in a city that was 80% underwater. The zone of destruction in New Orleans is 5 times the area of all of Manhattan, not just the 16 or so acres that were in the World Trade Tower footprint. So Nagin deserves some consideration on that ground. My criticism of him begins to get a little more peevish and irritable when, in the planning phase for the recovery, Nagin basically sabotages, as it seems to me, his own planning, his own Bring Back New Orleans Commission and their recommendation, strongly supported by all the urban planners on earth, that the city pause, retrench, reconsider where parts of the town might not be safe for rehabilitation. Nagin had a political campaign. It was a very unfortunate coincidence that he was due for re-election within a few months of the storm, and he got into political mode, and all of a sudden people were being encouraged to rebuild, were being given permits when they shouldn't have been. In fact, the city permits department was rejiggering the numbers so that houses that in fact had been more than half destroyed could be declared less than half destroyed and therefore avoid the kinds of, raising of those structures, the elevation of those structures that's required by FEMA. I might mention that we've had a particularly helpful boost from the planning community, and in particular a guy from the Champaign-Urbana area, Rob Olshansky, who's with the university there and is in the planning department. He has become perhaps the reigning expert on the whole rebuilding of New Orleans and the efforts by community groups to pull themselves together and do what the politicians have been so clumsy about trying to do themselves. Effectively, the planning process that's meant to be sponsored by the city has not yet begun, and it should have begun within a month of the hurricane. That said, neighborhood groups have risen from their own ruin and shown remarkable resolve and creativity with the support, in some cases, of university communities and university professionals. But it's Olshansky is right in the middle of all that, and I suspect we'll be seeing a book from him one fine day.
How has the nation done in terms of our response to this great American city's tragedy?
Initially, the response was astonishing and heartwarming. There was such genuine compassion for New Orleans, which is a beloved city, even after people see images of looting and so on the television.
Mm-hmm.
There was an international outpouring of philanthropy. My book is not all gloom and doom. I find some appalling stories to tell as I thread my way through this event. But there are also some stories of great strength and heroism, and one of them is this guy Malik Rahim, who was a between jobs, a grandfather, not a lot shaking at that point just prior to the storm, and by dint of some statements that he managed to get up onto the Internet and some radio interviews, he became the lightning rod for this international outpouring of philanthropy, which he put to astonishingly good use through an organization called Common Ground that he founded. There were health clinics and there were groups, teams that came in and did gutting of damaged houses, outreach to the Hispanic community, which is flooded in here to work in the construction trades. And then there was an equivalent, and he had a role in this as well, helping these folks find places to stay, outpouring of college students who decided against the beach in Destin or Fort Lauderdale for their spring break and came down to New Orleans. I think there were 10,000 young people who showed up during spring break, and it was an absolutely amazing contribution. Faith-based groups have been very, very helpful. Churches have made, New Orleans their sort of avocation for the year and have done yeoman work. This is tremendously impressive and important to the recovery. The danger, alas, and one that I hope to shake people out of, is this Katrina fatigue phenomenon, where people, oh, well, you're already well, right? That was months ago, so surely the city is back together. Or the other side of the coin, which is to say, New Orleans no longer is there, right? You hear from the likes of Dennis Hastert, maybe New Orleans never should have been put there. It's below sea level. What are you, crazy to live there? This is not helpful. There will always need to be a city at the mouth of the nation's most important riverway. And if Washington can't figure out how to do it, if Washington is not embarrassed by the disgrace that comes with failing to rebuild New Orleans, well, the Dutch know how to do it. And we have sought the advice of the Dutch, and they are fully able and demonstrably successful in figuring out ways to manage water and hydrology in at the mouth of the Rhine, in their case, areas that are very, very close to sea level or slightly below it. Their wake-up call was the flood in 53. Ours should have been, Betsy. It partly was, but we obviously have a great deal more work to do. And we need the support of the nation to keep Congress on point and to keep the money coming intelligently towards the rebuilding and then the greater fortification of our flood defense.
Mm. One can hope, I think, as well, that books like yours now, there are a number coming out. There are a couple out already. Yours is one of them. That this will help tell the story and remind us of what happened and of the people that are affected, and it will lessen that likelihood of Katrina fatigue.
Well, I hope so. My strategy with the book, people say, why'd you write this book? It just happened. We just read the newspapers. Well, I read the newspapers. I also, participated in mm-hmm. the creation of the newspaper stories, and I watched and chronicled a city disintegrating. As I contemplated writing this book and realized basically that I couldn't not write this book because I felt I had been entrusted with unbelievable and deeply personal stories that needed to get out there, frankly. I don't want to make too much of this. The great storytelling is by the people who survived this storm, not by me. I feel like a curator of this extraordinary trove of human drama, human agony, and in some cases, human success and achievement. I had seen, as we all had, the sort of helicopter pilot's eye view of this storm. There's the people on the roof waving their hands and screaming, and there's the houses floating away. I wanted to know what it was like to be on that roof. And mm-hmm. in the case of a woman like Petrina Peters, mm-hmm. to cite an example, I was able to find a woman articulate enough to explain herself, why she was there in the first place. This was a woman who didn't have to stay. She was offered rides out. She was there for Katrina. She was there clutching at her daughter and trying to sing hymns into the gale to calm her own nerves when all of a sudden the whole house rises up off of its foundations and she is swept away with her daughter. I needed to know what that was like. I needed to know what it was like for Charmaine Neville to have been chased by floodwaters out of her house and to find herself a refugee on the roof of a local schoolhouse. Having survived the storm, only to be attacked by a rapist, and she became one of the people who drew attention to the incidents of rape during in Katrina and in its immediate aftermath. I also wanted to know about the less vulnerable parts of the population and how they had handled it. I was fascinated by a guy named Gregory Richardson, who came up out of the streets. Father was a fruit peddler, no money there, but an African-American businessman. He put together a substantial little real estate empire, 48, 50 rental apartments. What's it like for Gregory Richardson all of a sudden to find himself using a door for a kickboard as he swims away from his own flooded home and to suddenly realize that everything he has, all 50 of those units that he has cobbled together over 20 years in the business, however long it's been, are underwater? And that, and then more interestingly, later in the later parts of the book, because I thread back and forth and come upon these people again, what does it mean for New Orleans that Gregory Richardson is or is not rebuilding, and what does it mean for Gregory Richardson that he is or is not getting any kind of meaningful support from the city or from his insurers or from the Small Business Administration? That to me was too intriguing not to follow. I, of course, as a media person, am in close touch with and write extensively about some of the difficult decisions that the media people made for all of our mistakes. There was also some strong moral thinking going on. I follow one guy, a photographer, who really almost just chucks his cameras, indeed sets them aside, because his dilemma is, when do you step back into the frame? When does this voyeuristic, parasitic existence that we media people exist in finally inadequate? When you've got people around you dying, when you've got people around you who need to be rescued, where do you? At the same time, you need to document it. That's what you're paid to do. The world does indeed need to know these stories, and won't if you abandon your craft. But where do you draw that line? where is the line to be drawn between the looting for survival and looting for sheer greed? And I was able to meet a guy named Earl Farrell and write his story. He is a young man, hot wires a bunch of cars, gets his girlfriend and her family out of town, but not without helping himself to additional trove of goodies that he can pull out of stores. Where is the line? Where does the hero end and the rogue begin? Where does the felon replace, the amorous suitor of the young woman that he rescues? These are the stories that you needed the length of time of the several months that one could reflect on these events, and therefore rethink New Orleans after first watching its disintegration.
Yeah. Well, you've done a very fine job of stitching all these stories together, and you must have done it in a fever almost.
I did. I've ruined my shoulders as a result of typing this thing frantically as I did. I holed up on my bed and just hammered away. I was driven to do that. I mean, these are stories that people need to know. This is an experience so shocking that you cannot believe that it happened in America. You cannot believe that the response was as laggardly as it was, or that the disaster that precipitated that response was as horrific as it was. And my mission, I've been accused by some people of really it's too raw. So, local people, I was quizzed the other night at a book reading session. This is just too much, Jed. Do we have to be exposed to this? And my answer is yes. And not only do you have to be exposed to it, but if we have to make it raw to catch the attention of the people outside the flood zone, outside the disaster zone, all across this country, well, that's the idea. And we need their support, and they need to draw on the example and the experience of Louisiana, because this ain't the end of it.
Oh. Reporter and editor Jed Horn, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of Breach of Faith, Hurricane Katrina, and the Near Death of a Great American City. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us with a telephone call. Your questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. A lot of New Orleanians didn't want to leave their city, no matter how dire the warnings were. Other people were unable to leave. I have some questions here, all involving those facts. How had the city weathered past hurricanes? Why did people want to stay put? And what should we know about those who couldn't leave?
Hurricanes are huge sociological as well as meteorological events. They're weather, and they're also a community, in a real crisis, a state of extreme stress and testing. And New Orleans, with all of the complexity that implies, New Orleans responded to Katrina in all of those different ways. One guy I know who has lived all his life in New Orleans said very succinctly and tellingly, "Camille is what killed us." And what he meant by that was Hurricane Camille, which happened in 1969, for many years, and perhaps still to this day, I'm not exactly certain of the record books here, the worst, most powerful storm on record, just missed New Orleans and plowed into Gulf Coast, Mississippi, not far from where Katrina plowed in, actually, and absolutely erased communities past Christiane, parts of Bay St. Louis, and then just an apocalyptic storm, Category 5, I think, even as it approached land, whereas Katrina had shrunk down to Category 3 by the time it made landfall. But Camille, though, whipping New Orleans pretty bad, did not do anything like what it did to the Gulf Coast. And so people think, well, okay, we survived that one. We can survive anything, or else their instinct is more superstitious. We're blessed. We're charmed. It went away, as so many storms do. They Ivan, George, how many of them in recent years have made a hook to the east at the last minute, and New Orleans loses some trees and some shingling comes off, and then everything else is as it was before. There are other factors that contribute to keeping people where they are. One of them is a fear of losing what they have, mm-hmm. of people coming after the storm, as they always have and always will, no doubt, as they did in Cancun, as the storm hit down there, as they have every time the lights dim in New York City with a power outage. I mean, New Orleans doesn't have any kind of a monopoly on looting, and so people have responded to past evacuation orders by digging in and protecting their property. More typically, though, the response is, hey, it's a party, we're a party town, here comes a storm, let's get out the grills, the meat's going to go bad anyway when the electricity fails, let's have a beer, and there's a sense of camaraderie, perhaps a sense of fatalism, if you will, because really, what can you do? I mean, ordinarily, people are not going to be killed in storms, and so they ride it out, as they say around here, and this time the consequences were ghastly. Now, there is a population, and it is not to be dismissed lightly, of people who simply don't have the wherewithal, who are not functioning at a high enough level, aren't in charge enough of their lives to make those difficult decisions. A mother with a bunch of kids, an elderly guy, living in a cottage. It's hard for them to get out if they don't have a car, and it's hard for their neighbors to look after them, which has been the traditional way things were done in New Orleans. Everybody just kind of looked after their neighbors. If it's many, many children, how are you going to fit them all in the car? Mm-hmm. There are just a lot of problems. And then you have the elderly who really can't move, and the ill, and those are the people who wound up in the Superdome to their great regret after the situation got so horrible there.
Yeah. Well, the dome, that was so hard reading about that. That comes fairly early in the story, the dome. There's a chapter called Real Ugly, Real Fast. And old and infirm people were dumped.
Yeah. It was disappointing to the special responders who were on those loading docks helping those people in. But nursing homes would drive up in a van, dump the elderly onto the loading ramp, and then disappear in the van, and these people were just left to burden and overwhelm the rather fragile reception committee of medical people that had been set up there. Families would sometimes do the same thing, or inadvertently, a family would leave grandma out there on the deck to begin hooking her up to IV or getting her maybe helicoptered out. People would drift into the arena itself, the central part of the dome, come back out to look for grandma, and she'd been whisked away, and nobody knew where, which, needless to say, was traumatic for the elderly person and likewise for the family members who had intended, perhaps, to stay with their elderly loved ones, but got lost in the shuffle.
Yeah. Also, people were abandoned where they were, people who should have not been. That was the situation in other places. And maybe you tell us a little bit about what, looking back now, what happened at the hospitals?
Well, yeah, let me mention first the nursing homes, which were perhaps an even more startling problem. And Mississippi definitely outclassed Louisiana here. Mississippi simply issued a mandatory order that all nursing homes in the flood or the strike zone of the hurricane be evacuated. There was some ambiguity. I mean, legally, I think they were supposed to evacuate in Louisiana, but they somehow didn't. And in one instance, 35 people died in mm-hmm. one nursing home. It was just simply swept away, and St. Rita's Nursing Home. And the owners of that facility, who had been warned and who had defied directives, I suspect will wind up in prison. I mean, this is an absolutely irresponsible, unconscionable thing to have done. The hospitals were a different situation. Hospitals are big, strong buildings for the most part, and certainly Charity and the Tulane Hospital and the University Hospital, which are all in the downtown area, are massive buildings and could be thought of and have traditionally been thought of as shelters. People would go there. You'd bring your friends if you're a nurse or a doctor. You'd bring your family, and you might even bring, a stray friend or two to the hospital, and wait out the storm and then head back out onto the streets and rebuild your life or reshingle your house or whatever. In this case, you had, I think there were all told, close to 1,000 people in Charity, the big public hospital in New Orleans. And, well, one moment of enormous frustration. 3 or 4 days after being trapped there and running out of food, running out of oxygen, no power to run all the parts of the hospital that these days are, you know, electricity dependent. Somebody turns on the radio and CNN is announcing the successful evacuation of Charity Hospital. I mean, this communications breakdown was pretty complete, but they were trapped there, and it was just awful. They had to manually, do the bags that help people to breathe, people who are on resuscitation and oxygen tents and so on. I mean, just, there you sit for 14 hours being with your arm somebody's lungs, just a nightmarish scenario. And, of course, sewage backed up and infection, spread through these hospitals, diarrhea. I mean, it was an absolute nightmare. And finally, on, I think it was Thursday, after a Monday strike, a Monday storm, these hospitals were finally evacuated. The Army got in there, the trucks, the boats, the planes, and all the rest of it. And they were relieved and whisked off to Baton Rouge or Texas or wherever.
There's a woman you write about in the book by the name of Sherry Waters, and she was at the Superdome. She volunteered for duty. She worked for the department. Maybe she still does, the Department of Social Services.
Mm-hmm.
How does she speak of what happened there, and how did she... You know, it's like the people who hung in there with their patients at the hospital. You know, what was her experience?
Well, her experience shaped a lot of my understanding of this whole mess. I mean, she was a marvelous guide into this maelstrom because she happens to be exceedingly articulate. She's not actually a medical person, though she was assigned. She works for the Department of Social Services, and she volunteered, I should say. She was not assigned. She volunteered to work on the receiving docks with the special needs, so-called special needs people, most of them ill, some of them merely very, very old. She's actually a lawyer by training, and as such, she has been a very acerbic and sharp-minded critic of the process that she participated in, and in fact has written, I wish I had had it in time to include it in the book, she has written a long sort of memorandum or treatise in which she, in no uncertain terms, urges various reforms about how this situation should be handled. I suspect Sherry, who is a very persuasive person, big strapping woman, I mean, as strong and pure of heart, a real mensch, I expect that she will be able to bring about some reform because she's that kind of, she's a force larger than life and a very, very persuasive woman. She happens to be, I mean, some of the fun, if that's the right word for it, of writing this book was to find the connections between people. And having met this woman who, was on the rooftop with her daughter floating away, in a marvelous bit of coincidence, it turned out that Sherry knew her and found her in the Superdome, two, 3 days later, and had been in touch with this woman's son, Demond, who she in fact had a relationship with as a tutor through a literacy program or something like that, a teenage son, and Sherry, a woman who's, she's probably 35, 40 years old. And that was kind of amazing to me, and it suggested the sinew and the interconnectedness of so many different parts of New Orleans that are the city's best chance for recovery. Sherry's white, Petrina's black. Sherry lives modestly, but in the part of town near the racetrack, for those of you who have ever been to Jazz Fest, she lives near that, a mixed neighborhood. Petrina and her family were living in the Lower Ninth Ward, which was almost entirely a black community. And yet across that divide, that cultural divide, there was this really wonderful connection made and interaction that I think very much helped save Petrina's life. She was a woman with some health problems, and Sherry was able to get her right onto a helicopter and get her out of there. But some of those same connections figure across this book, and it sort of has some of the feel of a soap opera, of a sort of a grim sort, but the way these serial narratives weave and break apart and come back together again was part of the fun of writing it and helped to structure this otherwise enormous body of material into a coherent narrative.
Hmm. Petrina Peters, you open the book with her, and that's where it closes, right, with her. We find her in the opening about as the storm is about to hit, and then at the end, we leave her not long after her home has been bulldozed, correct?
Yeah. She was useful to me as a way to bookend this story, and she crops up here and there in the middle of it. Because I think she is very representative of so many things that people need to know about New Orleans. One is that she is a woman of great strength and resourcefulness. Another is that, though not rich by any stretch of the imagination, she is typical, really, of the Lower Ninth Ward, which is so completely misunderstood by people. She is the daughter, third-generation family of pastors, who led, her grandfather led a community of African American Baptists up out of the Chalmette battlefield, where there was a little enclave of them living residentially called Fezendeville. They were booted out of Chalmette at the time of an anniversary of the Battle of New Orleans, which was fought at the Chalmette battlefield. Anyway, that happened back in the 60s, and she. Her tribe was led by this pastor up into this Lower Ninth Ward area, and artisans among them built many, many of these houses. She's financially independent and self-sufficient. And also, as we were saying earlier, she's one of these people who, like many of those who'd stayed behind, did so voluntarily and were not simply these hapless, you know, sort of losers as they have been portrayed in the media, sometimes mm-hmm. by people seeking to extend benevolent goodwill towards these people. New Orleans has a class of people who are very dependent, and it also, far more of New Orleans, is very strong, very independent, very, very feisty, because we've learned not to depend much on government around here, and that lesson was only more forcefully driven home when the federal government failed us so completely after first building the levees and then failing to come into the city to help with the rescue.
Mm. We're almost out of time, and before we go, I mean, we haven't touched this question, but it's a big one, and it's an important one, and it's an obvious one. Almost a year later now, where is New Orleans in terms of being prepared for the next time?
Well, there have been lessons learned. We certainly have a different attitude towards mass transit and the availability of buses and all of that. The Army Corps has, I think, made some huge improvements in the flood defenses. The canals that flooded, the so-called outflow canals, have been gated, which means that the storm surge cannot penetrate into the heart of the city and then blow down the walls and the levees. The Dutch, you know, put it very succinctly. We went over to Holland to see about their system. As they said, you take the battle to the enemy. You don't let the enemy come in and do battle in your own heartland. And that's a big improvement. The levees have been reconstructed. But we still need this vastly different in magnitude commitment to making New Orleans a safe place, because there has to be a New Orleans, because there will always be a Mississippi River, and there will be a need to service the huge numbers of ships and barges and rail lines that intersect there, even if you don't care about the soul of the city. And if you do, then you know New Orleans is one of the most distinct and fascinating regional cultures in this nation. Beautiful architecture and food and music and all of that, and to lose it, to let it go simply because we decided it was had served its time or was foolish or decadent or somehow undeserving of national response would be, to me, criminal.
Mm. What are Ms. Peters' hopes for her city?
She is torn. She misses New Orleans terribly. She's found a comfortable place in a suburb out of town. She's certainly not going to stray far. She initially decided she wasn't coming back. It was just too painful for her.
Mm-hmm.
But what will bring her back, I think, is her church. She has not been able to find the kind of religious community in the suburbs that she so thrived among in New Orleans. And I think if that church gets itself back up, as it probably will, the building survived. It's called Battleground
Baptist.
It's coming back, therefore Petrina is coming back because that's the heart of her social world.
Battleground Baptist.
Yeah,
it's a great name.
Perfect name.
That's a perfect name for a church.
Yep, and you should see the building. It's this squat, tough little thing standing there amidst this absolute ruin of the lower Ninth Ward. Cars still flipped up into trees and houses collapsed all around, but there it sits.
Jed Horn, thank you very much for telling these stories and for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you for the forum. People need to know this stuff.
Yeah, right. Jed Horn, author of Breach of Faith, Hurricane Katrina, and the Near Death of a Great American City, the book published by Random House. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Oh, no, it's Todd Gleason.
It's Todd Gleason. I'm sorry.
I'm
go ahead.
Actually here.
Okay.
I'm still here. I've not made my trip yet. I'm not gone. I'll be here there. It's the afternoon. Now, next week, won't be either of us, actually.
Yeah.
So you'll have to figure out who's
in the chair.
Who's in the chair.
What happened today on the board?
Well, on the board this week and today, futures finished a bit higher, in fact, for the day, up about one and a half cents. In the wheat, corn futures were up a penny and a half for the day. And the soybeans were up anywhere between a half cent and 4.5. There was the far deferred November. It finished down a quarter, but it was the odd one out of the bunch for the afternoon. In the wheat pits for the day, July contract in Kansas City, a 487 settlement price up to there. Spring wheat finishing July contract at 520. It was 12 higher the day. September up a penny and 3/4 at 508. That, of course, trading in Minneapolis at the Minneapolis Grain Exchange. July wheat in Chicago today, down a dime, 377, the high, the low at 63, settlement price at $3.66 for the day, off 10 cents in Chicago for the nearby contract. September futures, two higher at 397.5. By the way, July contracts across the board expired today, so that'll explain some of the discrepancies that you hear in those numbers. 399.5, the high of the SEPs, the low at 391. September priced at 397.5 at the end of the day. Now the lead option, it was two higher. December futures in the wheat pit, 418.75, the high, the low at 410. Settlement price at 417.5, up a penny and a quarter. In the March, 436, the high, the low at 427. Settlement price at 434.75. They were up 1.5 for the day. The May contract up 1.75 at $4.43. The high price as the same at 443. The low at 437. Corn pit now. July contract 255. The high, the low at 51. Settled at 53.5. They were up a penny for the day. September's up a half at 260.75. The high price there at 63.5. The low at 58.5. And December futures had a high price today, all the way up at $2.79.25. Settlement price at 274.25, settled at, that was their low, settlement at 276.75, up 3/4 for the December contract in the corn. March futures, 290 the high, the low at 85.5, a settlement price at $2.87.75, they were up 1/2 for the day. And the May futures, 297.25 the high, the low at $2.94, settlement price at 296.5, up a penny and a quarter. July contract a half higher, 303.25 the settlement price. The high at 05.5 and the low at $3 and a penny a bushel for the July 2007 corn. September futures, 308. The